On the Gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Emerging artist bumper music for the first couple hours tonight, and later on, Neil Donald Walsh joins us, continuing with his Conversations with God series. Here's what's happening. Protests turned violent in Northern California early Sunday when some mass demonstrators smashed windows while others pelted officers with rocks and bottles. Police said about 1,200 people were on Berkeley streets for another day of protests over a grand jury decision not to indict a New York City police officer in the death of a man on July 17th. That's that stranglehold case. A gang that was stealing ancient relics from a desert cave close to where the famed Dead Sea Scrolls were found, they've been arrested. The thieves were caught as they were leaving a site known as the Cave of Skulls. Their loot included a 2,000-year-old comb used to remove hair lice. Robbers have been targeting archaeological sites in the remote area, which was a hideout for Jewish rebels in the days of the Roman Empire. Investigative mythologist William Henry with us. William, I guess there's a lot of money in these relics, isn't there?
Oh, there's tremendous money, George. I mean, it's possible that what these thieves were seeking was actually part of what's known as the famous copper scroll hoard of relics and artifacts, including massive amounts of gold and other items from the treasure of King Solomon's temple.
Now, with these people being arrested, I guess there will be more and more people trying to find these relics now that they kind of know that there's some in that area. What do the Israelis do? How do they protect that area? The armed guards?
Well, they protect it by just trying to keep people out to begin with. I mean, this has been an ongoing problem since the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1947, and especially the Copper Scroll, where suddenly you know that there's massive amounts of gold buried in them, Nahr Hills, so they've got a lot of attention.
There must be some things in there that we haven't even discovered, William. There must be amazing things there.
Absolutely. I mean, the sky's the limit when you're talking about the treasure of King Solomon, gold relics from his temple to other items that might have been brought to Israel from other parts of the world. It's incredible.
And while I've got you, thanks for donating your time on the Holiday Magic Coast Style CD. I really appreciate that.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. It was a really great time to do my version of Silent Night, and I hope everybody enjoys it.
We'll look forward to talking to you again. William Henry. North Korea has denied hacking into the computer system at Sony Pictures in retaliation for a film depicting the country's leader, but has praised the attack as being a righteous deed. The attack crippled computers at Sony and led to upcoming films and workers' personal data being leaked online. Listen to this story. Two Saudi Arabian women activists have been detained for nearly a week for defying the kingdom's ban on women driving. The women who were arrested after driving into Saudi Arabia from the United Arab Emirates are supporters of a campaign launched in October of last year against the ban. The two women have a combined Twitter following now of more than 355,000. Two people killed, 12 others were injured by carbon monoxide poisoning in a record recording studio in a New Jersey town. A major police officer said they responded to a 911 call at 1:30 p.m. Saturday from the Streets rehearsal studio, and they found two people dead on the second floor of the three-story building, 12 other victims experiencing confusion and choking as they tried to leave the mixed-use commercial building. Amazing story. California's drought, they say, right now is the worst in 1,200 years. Now they're getting rain, but they say this one's a bad one. The original Batmobile has fetched, get this, $137,000 at auction. Now that's a small fraction of the $4.2 million that a buyer paid last year for another version built for the television show that aired during the 1960s. More than a dozen Pearl Harbor survivors, each more than 90 years old, gathered in Hawaii this week to share stories as they marked the 73rd anniversary of the attack that killed 2,400 sailors, Marines, and soldiers. The gathering has been called the last meeting for the USS Arizona Reunion Association, comprised of the remaining 9 survivors of the USS Arizona, a battleship that sank in the December 7th, 1941 attack. Who could forget Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
And how much did we actually know, though, about the attack prior to the attack? In a moment, historian Douglas Dietrich joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. You know, we are not going to forget Pearl Harbor. So many other media establishments have forgotten Pearl Harbor, and we will not. Lots happened on that day, and a lot of things happened leading up to the attack on Pearl Harbor. Douglas Dietrich, of course, appears on Coast to Coast quite regularly with me. He's the son of a retired U.S. Navy sailor. Douglas worked for 10 years as a Department of Defense research librarian at the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco. He was one of the major duties there was document destruction. He experienced the 1991 Kuwaiti campaign serving a Desert Storm as a U.S. Marine. Thank you, Doug, for that. Douglas has studied the connected historical process of the sacrifice of the USS Indianapolis, her captain, her crew following delivery of components critical to the deployment of the American atomic bomb. And here he is back on Coast to Coast on our Pearl Harbor special for the first couple hours, Douglas Dietrich. Douglas, thanks for spending the time with us.
Thank you, sir. I'm very honored to be here, and I'm very honored by the fact that I believe that we will be honored by the presence of yourself and Tom Danheiser, at least via Skype, at the UFOCon 2015 in March of next year in Santa Clara, which will be around before we even know it, right after this winter, where I'll be speaking on the Battle of Los Angeles. And I do want people to know that they can purchase their tickets for that at www.ufocon2015.com. And I do want people to understand how important and solemn this night is. I do talk about a lot of the background behind the Pearl Harbor attack, much of the military politics. And if people don't get enough of that here and through the Guyam television interview on Beyond Belief, which I conducted with Mr. Norrie, feel free to check out my website, DouglasDietrich.com. We're running our holiday DVD two-set special again this year with a new version of Roswell and the Rising Sun, plus the original version of Satan's Crusaders. So thank you so much, Mr. Norrie, for having me on
to talk
about that, as well as the real serious topic of those survivors that are left, and hopefully they'll learn some of the truth of why they suffered the way they did tonight.
I want you to give us a little background perspective, Douglas, about Pearl Harbor. Most of the people listening to this program weren't even born during that time period. Those who were probably infants or little children, so they don't understand the significance of it. Tell us what happened leading up to the attack on Pearl Harbor and why, in your opinion, it happened.
Well, definitely, we have a lot of facts that have literally conspired to make the attack take place. It was most certainly not a surprise attack. Everyone at this point historically is aware of the fact that the United States Navy very proudly, and is right to be proud of the fact that they broke the Japanese naval codes through what was known as their security group. And this was by January of 1941. Those codes, of course, were distributed to the British and all the allied colonial powers. And they definitely were able to read down exactly when the Japanese were going to attack within an operational matrix. What provoked that attack goes back to many different factors. One of them was the Queen of the Kingdom of Hawaii, Liliuokalani. She ascended the throne in 1891. She was deposed by the Dole dynasty of Dole Pineapple fame. Later on, they put out a scion to run for president, Robert Dole, and he was a senator. I believe he's retired now. But when his family and other corporate powers financed the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom. She went to Washington, D.C. to plead for her nation's freedom to end the American occupation in 1898. And the Spanish-American War began. She was forced to go back to the Hawaiian Islands, where she was forced to abdicate her throne, and she was kept under house arrest by the United States Marines until she died in 1917 in the middle of World War I. But before she died, her managing trustee and her treasurer until her death was a Japanese agent by the name of Curtis Iaukea, and his last family name was spelled Iaukea in the American Romanization. He was the acting governor of the Hawaiian Islands in 1920 during the Oahu sugar strike, and he was able to relay all of her pleas for liberation of her independent nation as occupied by the United States to the Japanese imperial dynasty. That was one factor in which the Japanese were asked by the Hawaiian people to liberate the Hawaiian Islands. That was one of the factors that led to the attack. There were, of course, many other attempts to provoke the Japanese. One of them was, of course, the cessation of oil supplies to Japan. Japan at that time got literally 95% of its fuel from the United States, which was the Saudi Arabia of its day. And because of this, when the Americans cut off oil to Japan, it would have been the same as if America had all oil from Venezuela.
Douglas, what could we have done to have prohibited or had the Japanese not attack Pearl Harbor? What kind of policies could have been in place prior to that that would have stopped it?
Well, the policies that would have stopped it would have been not having FDR as president.
Well, that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. Well, it could have happened in a sense if there had been alternatives to FDR during the Depression. Unfortunately, what we had was the veterans protesting the Hoover administration. They wanted to get paid for World War I. The American veterans had never been paid for that. And as a result, they picketed the White House. Hoover ordered in General MacArthur, General Patton, and General Eisenhower to attack the veterans with war gas left over from World War I.
You got to be kidding me. Near the White House?
Yes, that's quite correct. As a matter of fact, due to the fact that they were in Washington, D.C., it's important to remember that the Washington District of Columbia is not part of the United States. The laws of posse comitatus do not hold in Washington, D.C. That means the United States government can kill citizens there and not be held accountable. So many women and children were killed because they were families who were attending and picketing with the veterans by the likes of General Patton, who regretted it the rest of his life and was the most sympathetic of the trio. Eisenhower helped to cover up the crime for MacArthur and then tried to distance himself from what happened there after MacArthur.
Did the media cover that, Douglas? I mean, was it in the major newspapers of that time?
It was, and that's what got FDR elected, and because Hoover, of course, made himself quite rightly condemned. But when FDR got into power, he thought he could bring America out of the Depression by starting a war. So he went on a very aggressive stance of war mobilization. It's very important to remember that the Pentagon was built in and planned prior to the Second World War as the world's largest office building to manage the largest war the world had ever seen. And the man in charge of that project was General Leslie Groves. Now, when he took that spade and put it under his foot and turned dirt in the groundbreaking ceremony, that day was September 11th of 1941, prior to the Pearl Harbor attack.
Uh-huh.
He said right then, we're going to start the biggest war the world had ever seen, that we need all the steel to build tanks and planes and guns and ships, and therefore we can't use a single ounce of steel in the Pentagon, and that's why everything in the Pentagon is concretized and made of concrete. So there were no metal cables for elevators. Everything's on ramps. Everyone goes around on golf carts to get around the Pentagon. And, of course, they cleared out an entire neighborhood, the Hell's Bottom African-American neighborhood, told the men to join the military because a war was starting. And right across the Potomac River was the American hero Charles Augustus Lindbergh, who on September 11th of 1941, while General Leslie Groves was building this monument to America's next war, basically Charles Lindbergh said, said that this represents the new world order and it must be resisted. And his speech is available on YouTube, so this is part of history now. Now, what happened was the Americans planned to make a go of trapping the Japanese fleet after provoking them into attacking Pearl Harbor. They basically were going to bomb Japan first. They had organized the Flying Tigers as a mercenary air wing, illegal by international and domestic law, to accompany SEANAC planes. SEANAC was a corporation that stood for the acronym China National Aviation Corps, our company. And this was owned, of course, by Americans, and they were shipping opium throughout China. And these flights of opium were being interdicted by the Japanese, and the Americans had to escort them with armed escorts. Therefore, they brought in the mercenary wing of the Flying Tigers. Then they began to arm them, and one of the wings that they brought in, aside from some various Lockheed Hudson bombers, were B-17s. Now, the B-17 was more than capable of crossing the lower Pacific towards the southern islands of Japan, and that's why they were all caught on the tarmac on the day of the Pearl Harbor attack, along with what happened at Clark Field. At Clark Field, all of the planes were ready for shipping to the China front to bomb Japan. All of them were wingtip to wingtip, unarmed, because they were going to be packed for shipping. All of them, of course, got caught on the ground at Clark Air Force Base in Manila. What we had was a MacArthur administered strike on Taiwan, which was one day ahead, being on the other side of the international dateline. The Japanese caught it on the ground while they were rearming. They were arming all of their planes and fueling them to attack Taiwan, and they all blew up on the ground. That was even more devastating than what happened at Pearl Harbor. So the Japanese caught the attack with a preemptive surgical strike just on time. In both areas.
Now, I have always heard, Douglas, that we did get some ships out of Pearl Harbor and out of harm's way. Was that done intentionally?
I'm very glad you brought that up. It's very important to remember that this was an ambush. It was because they knew the Japanese were going to attack because of their provocations. They set up an ambush to trap and destroy the entire Japanese fleet. The U.S. carriers were operating evasive maneuvers in ambush, and the CV-2 USS Lexington had just left Pearl Harbor specifically to deploy 18 Voigt SB-2 Vindicator dive bombers on Midway Island to attack the approaching Japanese Pearl Harbor task force from the north and trap it in a pincer assault. The CV-6 USS Enterprise was just returning from a coordinated deployment of a dozen Grumman F-4F Wildcats on Wake Island to box in the Japanese Pearl Harbor task force from the rear, and was maintaining radio silence while lurking to ambush Japan's third wave, which they knew was going to happen because of their interception of all of their codes and their decoding of what they were saying. Now, with all of the pre-deployed land-based ship-killer aircraft in striking position from Midway and Wake, the CV-3 USS Saratoga was being held in reserve at San Diego to conserve force assets in case the Battle of Oahu resulted in any U.S. carriers down. But it was all ruined because the Americans prematurely struck. The USS Ward, DD-113, a destroyer, sank a Japanese submarine firing the first shot of the Pacific War a full hour and 5 minutes prior to the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor, warning the Japanese that they were heading into a trap. However, because Yamamoto knew that they had to make an attack at any rate to obey the Emperor's orders, he compromised and decided two waves and pull out the third wave when he calculated the Americans would try to ambush them. He calculated perfectly correctly. So at 06:15 hours, the Japanese launched their first attack wave. And at exactly the same moment, because the Americans knew they were going to attack, the USS Enterprise under Admiral Bull Halsey launched Scout Squadron 6 in a probing attack. It consisted of 18 Douglas SPD Dauntless dive bombers. They engaged the Japanese to confirm force ratios directly over Pearl Harbor. Rear gunner Bill Miller downed a Japanese aircraft. He was subsequently killed when a Zero downed his pilot's plane. And this was the first naval aerial kill of the Pacific War. Scout Squadron 6 was forced to scatter when a Japanese Zero rammed Ensign J. Voigt's SPD and disintegrated it in the first kamikaze attack of the Japanese-American War. And this was basically how Halsey got his extended reconnaissance when they returned to the carrier. So it's important to remember that Pearl Harbor was a battle. It was not a massacre. But the problem was the Americans were holding their forces, their assets in reserve. So Admiral Halsey was, by the way, hated for the rest of the war, and immediately after the war did not participate in the nuclear reconstruction of the American Navy. He was retired immediately after the war. Everyone hated him because he sat out the second Japanese attack wave with a fully armed and loaded carrier, and he knowingly waited while fouling.
Hold on for a second, Douglas. We're going to take the break and come right back as we talk more. You've had some fascinating research here. This, of course, is the 73rd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and Douglas Dietrich is our special guest. And by the way, you can see Douglas with my interview on Beyond Belief by simply going to this website. It's 10 days free, and when you do that, you can watch this interview. It is www.beyondbelief.com, and take a look at the job that Douglas Dietrich did on television. You will be amazed. We'll be back in a moment more with Douglas as we talk about Pearl Harbor on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Douglas Dietrich with us as we talk about Pearl Harbor. Douglas, my father died at the age of 88. He was, of course, in World War II as well. How about your father?
Yes, my father died at the age of 87, and I'm glad that your father lasted a year longer than he. I'm sure we both miss them terribly. I know we do. He served, he basically was in the China Theater during the Warlord era. He ran away from Rochester, New York, because it was run very, shall we say, almost oppressively by Eastman Kodak and the Kodak Company at the time, which played an enormous part in the Second World War's mobilization effort. When the war got rolling, of course, with lenses, various gun cameras, various technologies. Now, when my father was in China, of course, he was able to witness the combat that was going on between the Chinese and the Japanese firsthand. And at that time, the Japanese were considered friends by the Americans and the British, because their real enemies were the warlords and the bandits. People who wonder about the situation can watch The Sand Pebbles, starring Steve McQueen, and that portrays the situation my father was in very well. They were riding Spanish-American era steamboats, literally coal burners and whatnot, from that period of time, and they were literally at war with what at that time was the nationalist Chinese forces, not the communists, but the nationalist Chinese forces. So it was a very complicated political situation, but what made it much more complicated was the fact that the Chinese were very dependent on the Shanghai Stock Exchange and other coastal outlets or financial outlets for trade. In July of 1941, July 26th to be exact, FDR froze all of Japan's and China's assets in the United States and throughout the U.S.-dominated Western Hemisphere. It's very important to remember the largest Japanese population in the world outside of Japan is in Brazil. Now, this was a devastating act of war in and of itself, because it was far more than just a trade embargo. It eviscerated Japan's laboriously accumulated international monetary reserves, because by 1941, war all over the globe had congealed all of the financial systems of the world's powers into autarky blocks. So the currencies were incontrovertible, and abroad, the yen itself was rendered illiquid. That means that it was not acceptable for payments outside of the Japanese empire. So the United States, because of the Bretton Woods monetary agreement, which had basically pegged all of the world's currencies that were allied to the United States, the British, the French, the Dutch colonial empires, all of these currencies were pegged to the U.S. dollar. And this was rendered the only fluid currency in the world, because President Roosevelt, as soon as he had come into office in 1933, the same year that Adolf Hitler ascended to power, the first thing that Roosevelt did was something Hitler would never have done. He basically rendered the U.S. dollar away from the gold standard. He took it off the gold standard, not Nixon, but FDR. So he demanded everyone turn in their personal numismatic or gold coin collections, which is one reason why gold is so difficult to find in the United States.
Now, when people turned in their gold, did they get paid for it, or did they just lose it?
They lost it. You had families lose entire fortunes that they had saved up over generations to FDR and his socialist program of gold collectivization, which he said was going to bring us out of the Depression because he was going to take America off the standard and therefore needed to basically
take all the gold and sequester. You mean they never reimbursed people? I mean, if somebody brought in, let's say, 50 gold coins, and I don't know what they would have been worth back in 1940, 41, they got nothing for them?
That is quite right. They were told that this was a patriotic maneuver to take us out of the Depression, that we were going off the gold standard, and therefore all the gold had to be within government power. This is why
The
major business heads of the state tried to overthrow Roosevelt and approached Smedley Butler to participate as the figurehead while they handled the administration, because they knew at that point they were underneath a socialist administration. His chief Soviet advisor was Lachlan Curie, who had never in his entire life been awarded U.S. citizenship. He was basically a agent of Stalin who was in direct contact. This was exposed by the FBI. And when FDR was presented with the fact that the FBI was going to arrest him as Stalin's personal agent in the United States, FDR just sent him to China to liaise with the Chinese communists, Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai. This is what made the nationalists resent the Americans and ultimately, by the end of the war in 1945, side with the Japanese, which is why the nationalist Chinese, one of the founding member states of the United Nations, lost their position in the United Nations and the communist Chinese were brought in. Because the nationalist Chinese, the nation under which I was born on the island of Taiwan, switched sides at the end of World War II, ultimately took the Japanese island of Taiwan, which was never invaded throughout the Second World War, reestablished their government there because they got that in exchange for helping the Japanese maintain ports in China well after 1945. And that is one of the reasons we had such a complicated series of maneuvers in Asia politically that led to Korea and
Fascinating.
Vietnam.
Douglas, let me ask you this question. You know, your father was 87, my dad was 88. A lot of these folks are up there in age. We've got a lot of people who listen to this program. They're in their 20s. And, you know, World War II was never any part of their life. They some of them probably don't even know the history of World War II. What would you tell them tonight? They're listening to this program right now as we do our dedication on Pearl Harbor. What would you tell them tonight, Douglas, those who are in their 20s, let's say, listening to us right now saying, I don't know anything about this. Pearl Harbor was 73 years ago. I don't care. What would you tell them?
I would tell them that there's three things to pay attention to, particularly about the outcome of what started with FDR's machinations to start a war. One was the fact, of course, that the war did not end when people think it ended. People can look this up themselves. The war ended on September 28th of 1952. Until that period of time, the Empire of Japan and the United States were legally at war. It was very similar to the Korean War or Vietnam War situations where the United States occupied both Vietnam and Korea while simultaneously struggling against a faction of Koreans or Vietnamese that were hostile to the American occupation. Japan was under martial law and occupied until 1952 when that occupation legally ended, and throughout that period of time, America was facing a Cold War with Japanese forces that were in China. In strength, the Japanese had over 1 million men in China, well over that until 1952. And it's important to remember that this was called the San Francisco Peace Treaty. It was signed on site, the Presidio Military Base, where I worked for almost a decade. And even though it said that the war essentially, the signatory of many nations with Japan, the American allies, the Soviet Union did not sign it, China did not sign it, but the Anglo-American allied nations and Japan signed it. So this was something that was signed on September 8th of 1951, not effective until August 28th of 1952. Now, the important thing to remember about the war itself is that throughout the war, the United States was supporting billions of people in terms of their allies, the Soviet Union, China, which was nominally an ally, but mostly under the communists as opposed to the way it's presented with the nationalists.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's important to remember that the United States had to supply all these people, the French, the British. All of these people lost all of their oil supplies when the Japanese invaded the Dutch East Indies, when the Germans invaded various areas of North Africa and cut off the British from their supplies. They didn't have the North Sea oil fields back then. They couldn't develop these kinds of derricks that we have today, nor did the Soviets develop the natural gas reserves. So with Lend-Lease, Roosevelt gratuitously used 7 billion barrels of oil in World War II. Every single drop came from the United States. It depleted 95% of our proven reserves.
This Whoa.
Texas as the major source of petrol until the peak of easily accessible petrol in 1971. Since that time, we've been going downhill, except we've gone to shale oil. Now, until there is some abiotic resurgence in the original oil resources or source points.
Until they come back.
Yeah, which may take generations. It may take, we don't know how long it's going to take. We are in danger of collapsing because of FDR's largesse.
Okay, let's come back, though. Let's come back to my question, though, about that 20-year-old listening to you tonight who says, I don't care about Pearl Harbor. I didn't live during that time period. It was 73 years ago. It's over. Again, what do we tell them?
I would tell them that all the fear you have today that is emphasized by so many people in the alternative media information, shall we say, venue, everyone is warning you about potential oppressive governmental measures. This is the fear of us all of increasing government encroachment. All of this started with FDR and the Pearl Harbor attack because he took all of the Japanese Americans, American citizens of Japanese ethnicity, as well as many Germans and Italians who were U.S. citizens, revoked their citizenship, stole all of their property, whether fiscal or real estate, put them in internment camps under Executive Order 9066. Now, unfortunately, this went up to the Supreme Court decades later when Japanese were asking for remuneration along with many German and Italian Americans who had been interned throughout the war and lost everything, their homes, their savings from generations, etc. And the Supreme Court, in the most horrible decision of that tribunal's history, decided that this was constitutional. Now, since that point in time, nothing, NDAA, none of that matters because it all goes back to that. Once the Supreme Court said this was constitutional, that meant you as an individual or you as an ethnic group, and it's important to remember that Caucasians are the minority in many places in the United States today. The ethnic group that might be targeted today might be quite different from what was targeted back in 1941, but it has been rendered constitutional. You can all be taken and interred, all of your property stolen, and
gone.
Never returned. This is what happened to Nikola Tesla. Nikola Tesla told his son-in-law, who was a Yugoslav diplomat, he said, the Americans want me to work on this project for invisibility at Mondauk. I am not going to give them this power because of what they've done to United States citizens by revoking their citizenship. He gave an enormous amount of his plans to his son-in-law to take back to Yugoslavia. So his son-in-law did just that, everything that wasn't nailed down. Now, the moment he did that, the United States revoked his citizenship, and he killed himself. And at that point in time, the United States came and took all of his property, confiscated it. It's under national security to this day, and that property was confiscated under Executive Order 9066 by the OAP. The OAP no longer exists above board. It's an acronym people can look up called the Office of Alien Property. In other words, like every single Japanese American or targeted German or Italian ethnic American, Tesla was declared an enemy alien.
Jeez.
Citizenship was revoked.
At what point, Douglas, at what point after the war ended, did Germans and Italians and Japanese in this country start feeling as if they were part of the United States again?
Well, in a very real sense, that never happened because what happened was the Japanese mostly left. There are very, very few Americans of pure Japanese ethnicity in the United States today. Before World War II, official maps that were issued by the U.S. government used to have a map of the center of California, the San Joaquin Valley, the breadbasket of much of the United States. It feeds an enormous part of the world. That part of the United States alone in the Central Valley of California could feed a good deal of the world's population. The Japanese had honestly purchased it after so many generations of establishing themselves there. It was listed on government maps as Jap Valley. Now, when the Americans took all of that property and sold it for pennies on the dollar to Caucasians who came in and purchased it, that was never returned, and the end result is, of course, you've got a situation that we're all contending with today. We all live in fear of eminent domain. We all live in fear of all of this that was declared constitutional. The Japanese, of course, never came back. They went to Brazil. The majority of them who were interred in the United States moved back to Japan or lived in another part of the Western Hemisphere of the United States. Many Italians and Germans were overseas as business or exchange students in positions like that, as well as Japanese. It's important to remember, when the Hiroshima bomb was dropped on the city of Hiroshima, it killed 2,000 U.S. citizens. 2,000 U.S. citizens were in Hiroshima, and these were Japanese-American students or businessmen who were stuck with their families overseas, as well as many Caucasian prisoners of war that are not counted into that. But the United States said anyone who is overseas, this was, again, something that was concluded by the Supreme Court, because all of these Germans, Italians, Japanese, overseas, Romanians, any Axis allies, when the war started and America declared it, automatically, if you're overseas, and the United States declares war on a nation you're in, most Americans don't know this, you lose your citizenship. This happened during the Spanish-American War because of Roosevelt's Rough Riders and many of the USV or U.S. volunteers. If you ever take a look at their collar tabs, they don't say U.S. Army. They're all these mercenaries that say USV. That's United States Volunteer. That means they're paid thugs under the likes of Roosevelt or other private men who hired them, the forerunners of Blackwater or the ISIS corporation headquartered in Arizona. Now, what Roosevelt did with many people in Cuba, where American citizens had lived for generations, was they murdered many American citizens on the island of Cuba. They came back to the United States. People tried to sue them, and the United States government said, well, they're in such high positions of eminence and wealth, we can't do anything. So they said any citizen who lives overseas at a time of war is declared against the nation or the territory they're on is automatically the enemy.
What if you were on a business trip and you got stuck over there?
Then you are the enemy. So many of these German exchange students, Italians, etc., were forced to join the Axis because they were declared null and void as U.S. citizens. When they were captured by Americans later on during the war, many in the Africa Corps, many in the Italian units, they were brought to the United States. Their mothers and relations would often sue the U.S. government saying these were U.S. citizens. They should be able to stay here instead of being deported once the war ends. But the U.S. government said no. Due to that precedent set during the Spanish-American War because of American families killed, if you're overseas, you are the enemy. During a war that's declared against a nation that you happen to be in. And because of that, all of these men who were once U.S. citizens were deported. Many of them never returned. And because of that, this is the situation we're in today. You have a situation where Executive Order 9066 took place, was rendered constitutional, and that meant that the U.S. can take your citizenship away anytime they want, take your assets like they did to Tesla on an individual as well as on an ethnic level.
Don, does that include a U.S. citizen who was born here or somebody who was given citizenship?
This includes citizens born here, because many of the Japanese who were in those internment camps were second or third generation citizens.
Ah, okay.
Remember. So what makes this so dangerous is combined with that Spanish-American War precedent. You're not just an enemy if the government decides you're an enemy alien. You are also an enemy if you're overseas and war is declared where you're at. That means whether you're overseas or whether you're at home, the government could say you're an enemy whenever they want. That is the most important thing for a 20-year-old to learn.
I would guess so. Douglas, get your website out. We're coming up to the top of the hour. We're going to take calls with you next hour, but give us your website and how people can get a hold of what you do.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. We're basically go to the website at www.douglasdietrich.com, and certainly when you're there on the website, make sure that you go there and you'll be put on a mailing list where you'll be kept informed. So long as you opt for that, you'll be given information about when we're launching a new one on hopefully the 1st of January of next year. I do want to remind people, also go to UFOCon2015.com, where you can learn about what we're doing in March in Santa Clara, California, where barring anything happening to any of us, George Noy and Tom Danheiser should be with us at least via Skype, where while I'm presenting on the Battle of Los Angeles, and they'll be segued into the schedule at UFOCon 2015. And again, you can purchase your tickets at that site, UFOCon2015.com, at DouglasDietrich.com. Just make certain that if you can, order the DVD set, because it's very important to get the information on there to help contextualize much of what we're talking about right now.
All right, Douglas, we're going to come back. Here's our next emerging artist, Adam Lopez, and his Rhythm Review, the song Hitchin' Your Giddy Up from Westminster, Colorado.